They are always the best medicine, even on a day like today. The woman was still smiling as she walked away. A short, plump bear of a man, Carletto's father noticed Pino and turned even more delighted.
Pinolella! Where have you been? Where is your mother?
At home, Pino said, shaking his hand.
Bless her.
Mr. Beltramini peered up at him.
You're not going to grow any more, are you?
Pino smiled and shrugged.
I don't know. You do, you'll start walking into tree branches.
He pointed at the bandage on Pino's cheek.
Oh, I see you already did.
I got bombed. Mr. Beltramini's state of perpetual bemusement evaporated.
No. Is this true?
Pino told him the whole story, from the time he climbed out his window until he got back home and found everybody playing music and having a good time.
I think they were smart, Mr. Beltramini said. If a bomb's coming at you, it's coming at you. You can't go around worrying about it. Just go on doing what you love, and go on enjoying your life. Am I right?
I guess so. Is Carletto here? Mr. Beltramini gestured over his shoulder.
Working inside.
Pino started toward the shop door.
Pino,
Mr. Beltramini called after him. He looked back, seeing concern on the fruit vendor's face.
Yes? You and Carletto, you take care of each other, right? Like brothers, right?
Always, Mr. B. The fruitmonger brightened.
You're a good boy, a good friend.
Pino went inside the shop and found Carletto lugging sacks of dates. You been out? Pino said. Seen what happened? Carletto shook his head.
I've been working. You've heard of that, right?
I've heard stories about it, so I came to see for myself. Carletto didn't think that was funny. He hoisted another sack of dried fruit onto his shoulder and started down a wooden ladder and through a hole in the floor.
She didn't show up, Pino said.
Anna. Carletto looked up from the dirt-floored basement.
You were out last night?
Pino smiled.
I almost got blown up when the bombs hit the theater.
You're full of it.
I am not, Pino said. Where do you think I got this?
He peeled off the bandage, and Carletto's lip rose in disgust.
That's nasty.
4. With Mr. Beltramini's permission, they went to see the theater in the light of day. As they walked, Pino told the story all over again, watching his friend's reaction and feeding off of it, dancing around when he described Fred and Rita, and making booming noises as he related how he and Mimmo ran through the city. He was feeling pretty good until they reached the cinema. Smoke still curled from the ruins, and with it a harsh, foul stench that Pino would come to identify instantly as spent explosives. Some people in the streets around the theater seemed to wander aimlessly. Others still dug through the bricks and beams, hoping to find loved ones alive. Shaken by the destruction, Carletto said,
I could never have done any of what you and Mimmo did.
Sure you could. When you're scared enough, you just do it.
Bombs falling on me? I would have hit the floor and curled up with my hands over my head.
There was silence between them, as they contemplated the theater's charred and blown-out back wall. Fred and Rita had been right there, 9 meters high. And then...
Think the planes will come back tonight?
Carletto asked. We won't know until we hear the hornets. Chapter 4 1 Allied planes came from Milan almost every night the rest of June and on into July of 1943. Building upon building crumpled and threw dust that billowed down the streets and lingered in the air long after the sun rose blood red and cast down merciless heat to deepen the misery of those first few weeks of the bombardment. Pino and Carletto wandered the streets of Milan almost every day, seeing the random carnage, witnessing the loss, and sensing the pain that seemed to be everywhere. After a while, it all made Pino feel numb and small. Sometimes he just wanted to follow Carletto's instincts, to curl into a ball and hide from life. Almost every day, however, he thought of Anna. He knew it was stupid, but he frequented the bakery where he'd seen her first, hoping to run into her again. He never saw her, and the baker's wife had no idea whom he was talking about when he asked. On June 23rd, Pino's father sent Mimo to Casa Alpina in the rugged Alps north of Lake Como for the rest of the summer. He tried to send Pino as well, but his older son refused. As a boy and a young teenager, Pino had loved Father Ray's camp. He'd spent 3 months up at Casa Alpina every year since the age of 6, 2 full months in the summer climbing in the mountains, and a cumulative month skiing in the winter. Being at Father Ray's was great fun. But the boys up there now would be so young. He wanted to be in Milan, out on the streets with Carletto and looking for Anna. The bombing intensified. On July 9th, the BBC described the Allied landing on the shores of Sicily and fierce fighting against the German and fascist forces. 10 days later, Rome was bombed. News of that raid sent a shudder through Italy and the Lella household. "If Rome can be bombed, then Mussolini and the fascists are finished," Pino's father proclaimed. "The Allies are driving the Germans from Sicily. They'll attack southern Italy, too. It will soon be over." In late July, Pino's parents put a record on the phonograph and danced in the middle of the day. King Vittorio Emanuele III had arrested Benito Mussolini and imprisoned him in a fortress on Gran Sasso Mountain, north of Rome. By August, though, entire blocks of Milan lay in ruins. And the Germans were everywhere, installing anti-aircraft guns, checkpoints, and machine gun nests. A block from La Scala, a garish Nazi flag fluttered over the Hotel Regina. Gestapo Colonel Walter Rauf established curfews. If you were caught out after hours, you were arrested. If you were caught breaking curfew without papers, you could be shot. Having a shortwave would also get you shot. Pino didn't care. At night, he hid in his closet to listen to music and the news. And during the day, he began to adapt to the new order in Milan. The trolleys ran only intermittently. You walked, rode a bike, or hitched a ride. Pino chose the bike and went all over the city despite the heat, going through various checkpoints and learning what the Nazis looked for when they stopped him. Long sections of road had been reduced to craters, and he had to walk around them or find another route. Riding on, he passed families living under canvas tarps amid the brick ruins of their homes. He realized how lucky he was. He sensed for the first time how that could change in the blink of an eye, or the flash of a bomb. And he wondered if Anna had survived. 2. In early August, Pino finally understood why the Allies were bombing Milan. A BBC announcer said that the Allies had all but destroyed the Nazi industrial base in the Ruhr Valley, where much of Hitler's munitions had been built. Now they were attempting to blow up the machine tools of northern Italy before the Germans could use them to prolong the war. The nights of August 7th and 8th, British Lancasters dropped thousands of bombs on Milan, targeting factories, industrial facilities, and military installations, but also hitting the neighborhoods around them. When bombs exploded close enough to make the Lella's building tremble, Porzia panicked and tried to get her husband to take them all to Rapallo on the west coast.
No, Michele said. They won't bomb near the cathedral. It's still safe here.
All it takes is one, Porzia said. I'm taking Chichi then.
Pino's father was sad but determined. I'll stay and keep the business going, but I think it's time for Pino to go to Casa Alpina. Pino refused a second time.
It's for little boys, Papa, Pino said. I'm not little anymore.
On August 12th and 13th, more than 500 Allied bombers attacked Milan. For the first time, explosives struck close to the Duomo. One damaged the church of Santa Maria delle Grazie, but miraculously did no harm to Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper. La Scala was not as fortunate. A bomb blew through the roof of the opera house and exploded, setting the theater on fire. Another bomb struck the Galleria, which suffered extensive damage. That same detonation rocked the Lella's building. Pino waited out that horrible night in the basement. He saw Carletto the next day. The Beltraminis were heading to a train that would take them out into the countryside for the night to sleep and escape the bombardment. The following afternoon, Pino, his father, Aunt Greta, and Uncle Albert, and Tullio Galimberti and his latest girlfriend, all joined the Beltraminis in overnight exile. As the train left the central station and headed east, Pino, Carletto, and Tullio stood in the open door of a boxcar crammed with other Milanese fleeing for the night. The train accelerated. Pino looked at the sky, which was so perfectly blue he couldn't imagine it black and filled with warplanes. 3. They crossed the Po River, and long before dusk, while the countryside still lay blanketed in summer torpor, the train squealed and sighed to a stop amid gently rolling farmland. Pino carried a blanket over his shoulder and climbed after Carletto to a low grassy hill above an orchard that faced southwest toward the city.
"Pino," Mr. Beltramini said, "watch out or there will be spider webs across your ears by morning."
Mrs. Beltramini, a pretty, frail woman who always seems to be suffering some malady or another, scolded weakly.
"Why did you say that? You know I hate spiders."
The fruit shop owner fought against a grin.
"What are you talking about? I was just warning the boy about the dangers of sleeping with his head in the deep grass."
His wife looked like she wanted to argue, but then she just waved him away, as if he were some bothersome fly. Uncle Albert fished in a canvas bag for bread, wine, cheese, and dried salami. The Beltraminis broke out 5 ripe cantaloupes. Pino's father sat in the grass next to his violin case, his arms wrapped around his knees and an enchanted look on his face.
"Isn't it magnificent?" Michele said.
"What's magnificent?"
Uncle Albert said, looking around, puzzled.
"This place, how clean the air is, and the smells. No burning, no bomb stench. It seems so, I don't know, innocent?"
"Exactly," Mrs. Beltramini said.
"Exactly what?" Mr. Beltramini said. "You walk a little too far here and it's not so innocent. Cow shit and spiders and snakes and..."
Whop! Mrs. Beltramini backhand slapped her husband's arm.
"You show no mercy, do you? Ever?"
"Hey, that hurt,"
Mr. Beltramini protested through a smile.
"Good," she said. "Now stop it, you. I didn't get a wink of sleep with all that talk of spiders and snakes last night."
Appearing unaccountably angry, Carletto got up and walked downhill toward the orchard. Pino noticed some girls down by the rock wall that surrounded the fruit grove. None of them was as beautiful as Anna. But maybe it was time to move on. He jogged downhill to catch up with Carletto, told him his plan, and they tried to artfully intercept the girls. Another group of boys beat them to it.
Pino looked at the sky and said, I'm only asking for a little love.
I think you'd settle for a kiss, Carletto said.
I'd be happy with a smile, Pino sighed. The boys climbed over the wall and walked down rows of trees heavy with fruit. The peaches were not quite ripe, but the figs were. Some had already dropped, and they picked them up from the dirt, brushed them off, peeled the skin, and ate them. Despite the rare treat of fresh fruit right off the tree in a time of rationing, Carletto seemed troubled. Pino said, You okay? His best friend shook his head.
What is it? Pino asked.
Just a feeling.
What?
Carletto shrugged. Like life isn't going to turn out the way we think, that it's going to go badly for us.
Why would you think that?
You never paid much attention in history class, did you? When big armies go to war, everything gets destroyed by the conqueror.
Not always. Saladin never sacked Jerusalem. See? I did pay attention in history class.
I don't care, Carletto said, angrier still. It's just this feeling that I get, and it won't stop. It's everywhere, and...
His friend choked up, and tears ran down his face while he fought for control.
What's going on with you? Pino said.
Carletto cocked his head, as if peering at a painting he didn't quite understand. His lips trembled as he said,
My mama's really sick. It's not good.
What's that mean?
What do you think it means? Carletto cried. She's gonna die.
Jesus, Pino said. Are you sure?
I heard my parents talking about how she'd like her funeral to be.
Pino thought of Mrs. Beltramini, and then Portia. He thought about what it would be like to know his mother was going to die. A vast pit opened in his stomach.
I'm sorry, Pino said. I really am. Your mama's a great lady. She puts up with your papa, so she's like a saint. And they say saints get their reward in heaven.
Carletto laughed despite his sadness and wiped at his tears.
She's the only one who can put him in his place. But he should stop, you know? She's sick, and he's teasing her like that about snakes and spiders. It's cruel. Like he doesn't love her.
He loves your mama.
He doesn't show it. It's like he's afraid to.
They started to walk back. At the rock wall, they heard the strains of a violin. 4. Pino looked up the hill and saw his father tuning his violin, and Mr. Beltramini standing there, sheet music in his hand. The golden light of sunset radiated off both men and the crowd around them.
Oh, no, Carletto moaned. Mother of God, no.
Pino felt equal dismay. At times, Michele Lella could play brilliantly, but more often than not, Pino's father would stutter his rhythm or squall through a section that demanded a smooth touch. And poor Mr. Beltramini had a voice that usually broke or went flat. It was excruciating to listen to either man because you could never relax. You knew some odd note was coming, and it could be so sour at times it was, well, embarrassing. Up on the hill, Pino's father adjusted the position of his violin, a beautiful Central Italian petite from the 18th century that Portia had given him for Christmas 10 years before. The instrument was Michele's most treasured possession, and he held it lovingly as he brought it under his chin and jawbone and raised his bow. Mr. Beltramini firmed his posture, arms held loosely at his side.
There's a train wreck about to happen, Carletto said.
I see it coming, Pino said.
Pino's father played the opening strains of the melody of Nessun Dorma, or None Shall Sleep, a soaring aria for tenor in the third act of Giacomo Puccini's opera Turandot. Because it was one of his father's favorite pieces, Pino had listened to a recording performed by Toscanini and the full La Scala Orchestra behind the powerful tenor Miguel Fletta, who sang the aria the night the opera debuted in the 1920s. Fletta played Prince Calaf, a wealthy royal traveling anonymously in China, who falls in love with the beautiful but cold and bitchy Princess Turandot. The king has decreed that anyone who wishes to have the princess's hand must first solve three riddles. Get one wrong, and the suitor dies a terrible death. By the end of Act Two, Calaf has answered all the riddles, but the princess still refuses to marry him. Calaf says that if she can figure out his real name before dawn, he will leave, but if she can't, she must willingly marry him. The princess takes the game to a higher level, tells Calaf that if she finds his name before dawn, she'll have his head. He agrees to the deal, and the princess decrees, Nessun dorma, none shall sleep, until the suitor's name is found. In the opera, Caliph's aria comes with dawn approaching, and the princess down on her luck. Nessun dorma is a towering piece that builds and builds, demanding that the singer grow stronger, reveling in his love for the princess, and surer of his victory with every moment that ticks toward dawn. Pino had thought it would take a full orchestra and a famous tenor like Fletta to create the aria's emotional triumph. But his father and Mr. Beltramini's version, stripped down to its tremulous melody and verse, was more powerful than he could have ever imagined. When Michele played that night, a thick, honeyed voice called from his violin. And Mr. Beltramini had never been better. The rising notes and phrases all sounded to Pino like two improbable angels singing, one high through his father's fingers and one low in Mr. Beltramini's throat, both more heavenly inspiration than skill. "How are they doing this?" Carletto asked in wonder. Pino had no idea the source of his father's virtuoso performance. But then he noticed that Mr. Beltramini was singing not to the crowd, but to someone in the crowd. And he understood the source of the fruit man's beautiful tone and loving key.
"Look at your papa," Pino said.
Carletto strained up on his toes and saw that his father was singing the aria not to the crowd, but to his dying wife, as if there were no one else but them in the world. When the two men finished, the crowd on the hillside stood and clapped and whistled. Pino had tears in his eyes, too, because for the first time he'd seen his father as heroic. Carletto had tears in his eyes for other, deeper reasons.
"You were fantastic," Pino said to Michele later in the dark. "And Nessun Dorma was the perfect choice."
"For such a magnificent place, it was the only one we could think of," his father said, seeming in awe of what he'd done. "And then we were swept up, just like the La Scala performers say, playing con smania, with passion."
"I heard it, Papa. We all did."
Michele nodded and sighed happily.
"Now, get some sleep."
Pino had kicked out a place for his hips and heels, and then taken off his shirt for a pillow, and wrapped himself in the sheet he'd brought from home. Now he snuggled down, smelling the sweet grass, already drowsy. He closed his eyes, thinking about his father's performance, and Mrs. Beltramini's mysterious illness, and the way her joking husband had sung. He drifted off to sleep, wondering if he'd witnessed a miracle. Several hours later, deep in his dreams, Pino was chasing Anna down the street, when he heard distant thunder. He stopped, and she kept on, disappearing into the crowd. He wasn't upset, but he wondered when the rain would fall, and what it would taste like on his tongue.
Carletto shook him awake. The moon was high overhead, casting a gunmetal blue light on the hillside, and everyone on their feet looking to the west. Allied bombers were attacking Milan in waves, but there were no sightings of the planes or of the city from that distance, only flares and flashes on the horizon, and the distant rumor of war.
5. As the train rolled back into Milan shortly after dawn the next day, black scrolls of smoke unraveled, twisted, and curled above the city. When they left the train and went out into the streets, Pino saw the physical differences between those who had fled the city and those who had endured the onslaught. Explosive terror had bowed the survivors' shoulders, emptied their eyes, and broken the set of their jaws. Men, women, and children shuffled timidly about, as if at any second the very ground they trod might rupture and give way into some unfathomable and fiery sinkhole. There was a smoky haze almost everywhere. Soot, some of it fine white, and some a volcanic gray, coated almost everything. Torn and twisted cars. Ripped and crushed buildings. Trees stripped bare by the blasts. For several weeks, Pino and his father kept on in this pattern, working by day, leaving the city by train in the late afternoon, and returning at dawn to find Milan's newest gaping wounds. September 8, 1943, the Italian government, having signed an unconditional armistice on September 3rd, made public the country's formal surrender to the Allies. The following day, British and American forces landed at Salerno above the instep of the country's boot. The Germans offered mild to fierce resistance. Most fascist soldiers simply threw up the white flag upon seeing Lieutenant General Mark Clark's U.S. Fifth Army coming ashore. When news of the American invasion reached Milan, Pino, his father, aunt, and uncle all started cheering. They thought the war would be over in days. The Nazis seized control of Rome less than 24 hours later, arrested the king, and surrounded the Vatican with troops and tanks aimed at the Golden Dome of St. Peter's Basilica. On September 12th, Nazi commandos used gliders to attack the fortress on Gran Sasso Mountain, where Mussolini was being held. The commandos fought their way into the prison and rescued Il Duce. He was flown to Vienna and then to Berlin, where he met with Hitler. Pino heard the two dictators on the shortwave a few nights later, both of them vowing to fight the Allies to the last drop of German and Italian blood. Pino felt like the world had gone mad, and he grew depressed that he hadn't seen Anna in 3 months. A week passed. More bombs fell. Pino's school stayed closed. The Germans began a full-scale invasion of Italy from the north, through Austria and Switzerland, and installed Mussolini in a puppet government called the Italian Socialist Republic, with its capital the tiny town of Salò on Lake Garda, northeast of Milan. It was all Pino's father talked about early on the morning of September 20th, 1943, as they trudged back to San Babila from the train station after another night spent sleeping in farm fields. Michele was so fixated on the Nazis seizing control of northern Italy that he did not see one of those black smoke scrolls unraveling above the Fashion District and via Monte Napoleone. Pino did, and started to run. As he was weaving through the narrow streets a few moments later, the road curved, and he could see well ahead to the Lella's building. Where much of the roof had been, a gaping, smoking hole fed the smoke scroll in the sky. The picture windows of Le Borsette di Lella lay in blackened splinters and blades. The purse shop itself looked like the chipped interior of a coal mine. The blast had incinerated everything else beyond recognition.
Oh, dear God, no! Michele cried.
Pino's father let go of his violin case and fell to his knees, sobbing. Pino had never seen his father cry, or didn't think he had, and he felt gutted, sorrowful, and humiliated by witnessing Michele's misery.
Come on, Papa, he said, trying to get his father to stand.
It's all gone, Michele wept. Our life is all gone.
Nonsense, Uncle Albert said, taking his brother-in-law's other arm. You've got money in the bank, Michele. If you need a loan, I'll give it to you. An apartment, furniture, purses, you can rebuild. Pino's father said weakly,
I don't know how I'm going to tell Portia.
Michele, you act as if you had something to do with a random bomb hitting your place, Uncle Albert sniffed. You'll tell her the truth, and you'll start over.
In the meantime, you'll come stay with us, Aunt Greta said.
Michele started to nod, but then turned angrily to Pino.
Not you.
Papa?
You are going to Casa Alpina. You'll study there.
No, I want to be in Milan.
Pino's father went berserk.
You are not staying! You have no say in this matter. You are my firstborn. I won't have you die randomly, Pino. I couldn't take it. And neither could your mother.
Pino was stunned by his father's outburst. Michele was the sort to steam and brood about things, not to rage and yell, and certainly not on the streets of San Babila, where the gossips of the fashion world would take note and never, ever forget.
Okay, Papa, Pino said quietly. I'll leave Milan. I'll go to Casa Alpina, if you want me to.
Part 2. The Cathedrals of God. Chapter 5. 1. At the central train station late in the morning of the following day, Michele put a roll of lire in Pino's hand and said,
I'll send your books, and someone will be waiting for you at your stop. Be good, and give my love to Mimo and Father Ray.
But when will I come back?
When it's safe to come back.
Pino glanced unhappily at Tullio, who shrugged, and then at Uncle Albert, who studied his shoes.
This isn't right, he said, furious as he picked up a rucksack filled with clothes and boarded the train.
Taking a seat in a near-empty car, he stared out the window, fuming. He was being treated like a boy. But had he gone to his knees and cried in public? No. Pino Lella had taken the blow and stood there like a man. But what was he supposed to do? Defy his father? Leave the train? Go to the Beltraminis? The train lurched and squalled, pulled out of the station and through the train yard where German soldiers guarded hordes of vacant-eyed men, many in shabby gray uniforms, loading flatbed cars with crates of tank parts, rifles, submachine guns, bombs, and ammunition. They had to be prisoners, he thought, and that upset him. Pino stuck his head out the window and studied them as the train left the yard. 2 hours into the trip, the train rolled through the foothills above Lake Como, heading toward the Alps. Ordinarily, Pino would have stared lovingly at the lake, which he thought the most beautiful in the world, and especially the town of Bellagio on the lake's southern peninsula. The grand hotel there looked like some rose castle in a fantasy. Instead, the boy's focus was down the hill from the train tracks, where he kept catching glimpses of the road that hugged Lake Como's eastern shore, and a long line of lorries crowded with filthy men, many in the same sort of dull gray outfits he'd seen back in the train yard. There were hundreds, maybe thousands of them. Who were they, he wondered? And were they captured? And why? He was still thinking about the men 40 minutes and a change of trains later, when he got off at the town of Chiavenna. The German soldiers on duty there ignored him. Pino walked out of the station feeling good for the first time that day. It was a warm, sunny, early autumn afternoon. The air was sweet and clear, and he was heading up into the mountains. Nothing else could go wrong now, he decided, as he crossed through the station. Not today, anyway.
Hey, you, kid, a voice called.
A wiry guy, roughly Pino's age, leaned up against an old Fiat two-door coupe. He wore canvas work pants and a grease-stained white T-shirt. A cigarette smoldered between his lips.
Who you calling kid? Pino asked.
You. You the Lella kid?
Pino Lella.
Alberto Ascari, he said, thumbing his chest. My uncle told me to come pick you up, bring you to Madesimo.
Ascari flicked the cigarette and held out his hand, which was almost as big as Pino's, and to his surprise, stronger. After Ascari had almost broken his hand, Pino said, Where'd you get the grip? Ascari smiled.
In my uncle's shop. Put your stuff in the back there, kid.
The kid thing bothered Pino, but otherwise Ascari seemed decent enough. He opened the passenger door. The car was immaculate inside. A towel covered the driver's seat, protecting it from grease. Ascari started the car. The engine had a sound unlike any other Fiat Pino had ever known, a deep, throaty growl that seemed to make the entire chassis shake.
That's no street engine, Pino said.
Ascari grinned and shifted the car into gear.
Would any race car driver have a street engine or a transmission in his own car?
You're a race car driver? Pino said skeptically.
I will be,
Ascari said and popped the clutch. 2. They went screeching out of the little train station and swung onto the cobblestone road. The Fiat bounced sideways into a slide before Ascari whipped the wheel the other way. The tires caught traction. Ascari shifted gears and hit the accelerator. Pino was pinned against the passenger seat, but managed to brace his feet and arms before Ascari shot them across the little town square, deftly dodged a lorry filled with chickens, and shifted gears a third time. They were still speeding up when they left the town behind them. The Splugen Pass Road climbed in a steady series of chicanes, S-turns, paralleling a stream at the bottom of a steep-walled valley that cut north into the Alps toward Switzerland. Ascari drove the Splugen like a master, diving the car into every turn and weaving past the few other vehicles on the road like they were standing still. The whole time, Pino's emotions ran wild from abject fear to joyous exhilaration, envy, and admiration. It wasn't until they were approaching the outskirts of the town of Campodolcino that Ascari finally slowed.
I believe you, Pino said, his heart still pounding.
What's that? Ascari said, puzzled.
I believe you're going to be a race car driver someday, Pino said.
A famous one. I've never seen anyone drive like that.
Ascari couldn't have smiled more if he tried.
My father, he was better. The European Grand Prix champion before he died.
He raised his right hand off the wheel and pointed his index finger out the windshield and up toward the sky.
God willing, Papa, I will be European champion and more, world champion.
I believe it, Pino said again, shaking his head in awe before looking up at a sheer-walled gray cliff that rose more than 450 meters above the east side of the town.
He opened the window, stuck his head out, and scanned the top of the cliff.
What are you looking for? Ascari asked.
Sometimes you can see the cross on top of the belfry.
That's right up ahead here, Ascari said. There's a notch in the cliff.
That's the only reason you can see it.
He pointed up through the windshield.
There.
For an instant, Pinot caught a glimpse of the white cross and the top of the stone belfry of the chapel at Molta, the highest mountain settlement in this section of the Alps. For the first time that day, he allowed himself to be relieved he was out of Milan.
Ascari took them up the treacherous Madesimo Road, a steep, narrow, potholed and switchback route that hugged the steep mountainside. There were no guardrails and no shoulder to speak of in many places, and several times during the climb, Pino thought for sure Ascari was going to drive them right off the side of a cliff. But Ascari seemed to know every centimeter of the road, because he'd tweak the wheel or tease the brake, and they'd glide through every turn so smoothly, Pino swore they were on snow, not rock.
"Can you ski like this?" Pino asked.
"I don't know how to ski," Ascari said.
"What? You live in Madesimo and can't ski?"
"My mother sent me here to be safe. I work in my uncle's shop and drive."
"Ski racing's the same as driving," Pino said.
"Same tactics."
"You ski well?"
"I've won some races. Slalom."
The driver looked impressed.
"We were meant to be friends then. You will teach me to ski, and I will teach you to drive."
Pino's grin couldn't have been tamed if he'd tried.
"You have a deal."
They reached the tiny village of Madesimo, which featured a stone and slate-roofed inn, a restaurant, and several dozen alpine homes.
"Are there any girls around here?" Pino asked.
"I know a few from below. They like to ride in fast cars.
We should go for a drive sometime with them."
"A plan that I like," Ascari said, pulling over. "You know the way from here?"
"I could do it blindfolded in a snowstorm," Pino said.
"Maybe I'll come down on the weekends, stay at the inn."
"Come look me up if you do. Our shop's beyond the inn. You can't miss it."
He reached out his hand. Pino winced and said,
"Don't break my fingers this time."
"Nah," Ascari said, and pumped his hand firmly.
"Nice meeting you, Pino."
"You too, Alberto," Pino said. He grabbed his rucksack and climbed out. Ascari squealed away, hand out the window, waving. 3. Pino stood there a moment, feeling like he'd met someone important in his life. Then he put the rucksack up on his back and set out up a two-track path that headed into the woods. The way got consistently steeper until, an hour after he'd started the ascent, he emerged from the forest on a high alpine plateau below a rocky mountain face that climbed nearly 1,200 vertical meters to a crag of stone called Pizzo Gropera. The Molta Plateau was several hundred meters wide and wrapped around the Gropera to the southeast. The western edge of the wide bench ended where it met a small forest of spruces that clung to the rim of the towering cliff that fell away toward Campo Dolcino. Late in the day, with the sun like hammered copper shining on the autumn Alps, Pino felt awed by the setting, as he always did. Cardinal Schuster was right. Being in Molta was like standing on a balcony in one of God's grandest cathedrals. Molta was scarcely more developed than Madesimo. There were several alpine-style huts at the eastern base of the escarpment, and to the southwest, set back toward those cliffs and spruces, the small Catholic chapel Pino had caught a glimpse of from below, and a much larger stone and timber structure. Happier than he'd been in months, Pino smelled baked bread and something garlicky and savory the closer he got to the rustic building. His stomach growled. He ducked under the roof over the entryway, stood before the heavy wooden door, and reached for a cord that hung from a heavy brass bell above a sign that read, "Casa Alpina. All weary travelers welcome." Pino pulled the cord twice. The clanging of the bell echoed off the flanks of the mountain behind him. He heard the clamor of boys, followed by footsteps. The door swung open. "Hello, Father Ray," Pino said to a burly priest in his 50s. The man, leaning on a cane, was wearing a black cassock, white collar, and leather hobnailed climbing boots. Father Ray flung open his arms.
"Pinolella! I heard a rumor just this morning you were coming to stay with me again."
"The bombing, Father," Pino said, feeling emotional as he hugged the priest. "It's bad."
"I've heard that too, my son," Father Ray said, sobering. "But come, come inside, before we lose the heat."
"How's your hip?"
"It's been better and it's been worse," Father Ray said, limping aside to let Pino in.
"How is Mimo taking it, Father?" Pino asked. "I mean, our house."
"You should be the one to tell him that," Father Ray said. "Have you eaten?"
"No."
"Then your timing is perfect. Leave your things there for now. After dinner, I'll show you where you're sleeping."
Pino followed the priest as he caned awkwardly to the dining hall, where 40 boys crowded the rough-hewn tables and benches. A fire blazed in the stone hearth at the far end of the room.
"Go eat dinner with your brother," Father Ray said. "Then come sit with me for dessert."
Pino saw Mimo regaling his friends with some story of daring. He walked up behind his brother and said in a squeaky voice,
"Hey, Mr. Shortstuff, move over."
At 15, Mimo was one of the older boys in the room and obviously used to being the center of things. When he turned, his face was hardened, as if he were about to teach the squeaky-voiced kid a thing or two for not knowing his place in the world. But then Mimo recognized his older brother and broke into a puzzled smile.
"Pino?" he said. "What are you doing here? You said you'd never..."
Fear robbed Mimo of his enthusiasm.
"What's happened?"
Pino told him. His younger brother took it hard, gazed at the dark floorboards of the dining hall for several long moments before raising his head.
"Where will we live?"
"Papa and Uncle Albert are going to find a new apartment and a new place for the store," Pino said, sitting down beside him.
"But until then, I guess, you and I live here."
"Your supper tonight," a man said in a booming voice. "Fresh bread, fresh churned butter, and chicken stew a la Bormio."
Pino looked toward the kitchen to see a familiar face. A beast of a man with a shock of wild black hair and absolutely massive hairy hands, Brother Bormio was utterly devoted to Father Ray. Brother Bormio served as the priest's assistant in all things. He was also the cook at Casa Alpina, and a fine one. Brother Bormio oversaw the movement of steaming pots of the stew. When they were in place on the tables, Father Ray stood and said,
"Young men, we must give thanks for this day and for every day, no matter how flawed. Bow your heads, give your gratitude to God, and have faith in him, and in a better tomorrow."
Pino had heard the priest say these words hundreds of times, and it still moved him, made him feel small and insignificant, as he thanked God for getting him away from the bombardment, for meeting Alberto Ascari, and for being back at Casa Alpina. Then Father Ray gave his own thanks for the food on the table and bid them eat. After his long day of travel, Pino devoured almost a loaf of Bormio's brown bread and wolfed down 3 bowls of his heavenly chicken stew.
"Leave some for the rest of us," Mimo complained at one point.
"I'm bigger," Pino said. "I have to eat more."
"Go over to Father Ray's table. He hardly eats anything."
"Good idea," Pino said, ruffled his brother's hair, and dodged the sideways punch his brother threw. 4. Pino wove through the tables and benches to the one where Father Ray sat with Brother Bormio, who was taking a rest and smoking a hand-rolled cigarette.
"You remember Pino, Brother Bormio?" Father Ray asked.
Bormio grunted and nodded. The cook took two more spoonfuls of stew, another drag off the cigarette, and said,
"I'll get the dessert, Father."
"Strudel?" asked Father Ray.
"With fresh apples and pears," Bormio said in a pleased tone.
"However did you get those?"
"A friend," Bormio said. "A very good friend." "Bless your good friend, and bring us both two servings if there's enough," Father Ray said, before looking at Pino. "A man can only deprive himself of so much."
"Father?"
"Desserts are my only vice, Pino." The priest laughed and rubbed his belly. "I can't even give them up for Lent."
The pear and apple strudel was the equal of any pastry Pino had bought in his favorite bakery in San Babila, and he was grateful Father Ray had ordered him two portions. Afterward, he was so stuffed, he felt drowsy and content.
"Do you remember the way to Val di Lei, Pino?" Father Ray asked.
"Easiest way is southeast to the trail to Paso Angeloga, and then straight north."
"Above the village of Soste," Father Ray nodded.
"An acquaintance of yours went that way over Paso Angeloga, the Angel's Step, to Val di Lei just last week."
"Who was that?"
"Barbareschi, the seminarian. He said he met you with Cardinal Schuster."
That seemed ages ago.
"I remember him. Is he here?"
"He left for Milan this morning. You must have passed each other somewhere in your travels today."
Pino didn't think much of the coincidence, and for a few moments he gazed at the blazing fire, feeling mesmerized and sleepy again.
"Is that the only way you've gone?" Father Ray asked. "To Val di Lei?"
Pino thought, then said,
"No, I've gone twice on the northern route from Madesimo, and once the hard way, from here up the spine and over the top of the Gropera."
"Good," the priest said.
"I couldn't remember."
Then the priest stood, put two fingers in his mouth, and whistled sharply. The room quieted. Father Ray said,
"Dish duty, report to Brother Bormio. The rest of you, the tables are to be cleared and wiped down, and then you have to study."
Mimo and the rest of the boys seemed to all know the routine, and they got to their chores with surprisingly few grumbles. Pino retrieved his rucksack and followed Father Ray past the entrances to two big dorm rooms to a narrow cubicle with bunk beds built into the wall and a curtain across the front.
"It's not much, especially for someone your size, but it's the best we can do for the moment," Father Ray said.
"Who else is with me?"
"Mimo. He's had it to himself until now."
"He's going to be so happy."
"I'll leave you two to figure things out," the priest said. "You are older than the others, so I don't expect you to follow their rules. So here are yours. You must climb every day on a route I prescribe, and you must study at least 3 hours every day, Monday through Friday. Saturdays and Sundays are your own. Does that work?"
It seemed like a lot of climbing, but Pino loved being in the mountains, so he said,
"Yes, Father." "I'll leave you to unpack then," Father Ray said. "It's good to have you here again, my young friend. I can see now that having you around might prove to be a big help."
Pino smiled. "It's good to be back, Father. I missed you and Molta." Father Ray winked, rapped on the door frame twice with his cane, and left. Pino cleared two shelves and put his brother's clothes on the top bunk. Then he emptied his rucksack and arranged his books, clothes, and the pieces of his beloved shortwave radio, which he'd hidden among his clothes, despite the danger he'd have been in if the Nazis had searched his gear. Lying on the bottom bunk, Pino listened to a BBC dispatch on Allied advances, then dropped off into nothingness. 5.
"Hey," Mimo said an hour later, "that's where I sleep."
Not anymore, Pino said, rousing. You're top bunk now.
I was here first,
Mimo protested. Finders keepers.
My bunk wasn't lost,
Mimo shouted, before lunging at Pino and trying to drag him off the bed. Pino was much stronger, but Mimo had a warrior's heart and never knew when to admit defeat. Mimo bloodied Pino's nose before Pino could pin him to the floor. You lose, he said.
No!
Mimo spluttered as he squirmed, trying to get free.
That's my bed!
Tell you what, when I'm gone on weekends, you can use it. 4 or 5 days a week, it's mine, and 2 to 3, it's yours. That seemed to calm his brother.
Where are you going on weekends?
To Madesimo, Pino said. I have a friend there who will teach me to fix cars and to drive them like a champion.
You are so full of salami.
It's true. He gave me a ride up from the train station. Alberto Ascari, the greatest driver I've ever seen. His father was European champion.
Why would he teach you?
It's a trade. I'm teaching him to ski.
Think he'd teach me to drive too? I mean, I ski better than you.
You have vivid dreams, little brother. But how about I teach you what the great Alberto Ascari teaches me? Mimo thought about that and then said,
deal.
Later, when they'd turned off the light and Pino had buried himself under the covers, he wondered whether Milan was being bombed, how his family was, and whether Carletto was sleeping out in that meadow on the hill, or if he was awake and watching more of the city go up in fire and curling smoke. And for a second, he thought of Anna leaving the bakery, that moment he first caught her attention.
Pino,
Mimo said, as he'd begun to drift off.
Yeah, Pino said, annoyed. Do you think I'll grow soon?
Any day now.
I'm glad you're here.
Pino smiled, despite the swelling in his nose. I'm glad I'm here, too. Chapter 6 1 Pino was dreaming of car racing when Father Ray shook him awake the next morning. It was still dark out. The priest was silhouetted in the light of a handheld lantern he'd set on the floor outside the brother's narrow room.
Father? Pino whispered groggily. What time is it?
4:30.
4:30?
Get up and dress for a hike. You need to get in shape. Pino knew better than to argue. Though the priest had none of his mother's bravado, he could be as stubborn and demanding as Portia on her toughest day. With people of this nature, Pino had long ago decided it was better to get out of their way or go along for the ride. He grabbed his clothes and went to the washroom to dress. Heavy canvas and leather shorts, thick wool socks that came up over his calves, and a pair of brand new stiff boots his father had bought him the day before. Over his thin, loden-green wool shirt, he wore a dark wool vest. The dining hall was empty, except for Father Ray and Brother Bormio, who'd cooked him eggs and ham and toast. While Pino ate, the priest gave him 2 jugs of water that he wanted him to carry in his rucksack. There were also a large lunch and an oilskin anorak in case of rain.
"Where should I go?"
Pino said, fighting back a yawn. Father Ray had a map on hand. Take the easy way to the Passo Angeloga below Pizzo Stella. 9 kilometers there, 9 kilometers back.
18 kilometers?
Pino hadn't walked that far in a long time, but he nodded. Go straight to the pass and try to stay out of sight of others on the trail, unless it's unavoidable.
Why?
Father Ray hesitated. Some people from the villages around here think they own the Angel's Step. It's easier if you just stay away from them.
Pino felt confused by that, as he set out on a full stomach in the low light before dawn, walking along the trail that led southeast from Casa Alpina. The trail meandered in an easy, long traverse that followed the contour of the mountain, before slanting and losing